Cedric Muhammad. You are tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
Bruce from Chesterfield, Virginia, has given the teachings of his life. He's showing where he got his knowledge of business and entrepreneurship and finance. We'll read that a little later. He did vote for Terry McAuliffe yesterday. I would have voted for Terry myself. Wadu from Landover, Maryland, my brother, he says, peace. President Obama feels more authentic. He gets my one plus, but Snoop's greetings sound cooler. Karima from Bowie, Maryland, she says she loves it. For some reason, she prefers Snoop's greetings. She thinks Snoop Dogg's greetings of Assalamu Alaikum were said with more genuine love. But, however, Obama's Arabic enunciation was more proper. So you all seem torn. You find flavor in Snoop's greetings, yet you find technical excellence in Barack Obama's greeting. I'm going to talk about Cuba, but let's run this back one more time. Snoop, the jury seems to be that no longer out. Snoop's greetings are more authentically sincere and from Black America.
Assalamu alaikum. Assalamu alaikum.
Now here's the excellence of execution, Barack Obama, our president.
Assalamu alaikum. Assalamu alaikum.
Will you all fall for the excellence of execution, or will you have a soft spot for sincerity and twang? I got to read Bruce from Chesterfield VA's background. It's phenomenal. Let me talk about Cuba and why this is important. Now, I'm a big Hugo Chavez supporter. I'm sympathetic to Hugo Chavez. I'm sympathetic to Fidel Castro. I'm sympathetic to Muammar Gaddafi. You feel me? I'm sympathetic to any socialist or progressive, genuinely socialist or progressive person. I believe that they err on the side of egalitarian principles, and for that they get an A for effort. However, I do see problems, glaring problems, in their partial acceptance of the teachings of Karl Marx, I'll say. Now, I have read the book Das Kapital. It's like 800 pages. I have read it. Most communists and socialists I find don't demonstrate more than a surface reading of Karl Marx's teachings. They read the Communist Manifesto. Which is like, isn't the Communist Manifesto like 20, 30 pages or something? But Das Kapital, that's the book to read, because that's the book where Karl Marx deals with money and the nature of money, which every single communist and socialist country has failed to get right. Let me play a news report about what's going on in Cuba, so you'll have a better idea in context. Let's go to Peru, because I mentioned Hugo Chavez. It's getting hot over there. I read an article from a conservative publication about Hugo Chavez. Peru and Cuba, listen up.
Hundreds of Peruvian Indians are prepared to return to their communities. This after organizing a four-day-long bitterly violent protest against government plans to open the Amazon region to foreign investment. At least 55 people died in clashes led by the indigenous tribes opposed to Lima's plans to mine and drill oil in the jungle.
The protest began last week when police cleared a roadblock on a highway in the Bagua region of Amazonas province. The death toll rose over the weekend after Peruvian security forces battled indigenous groups to free dozens of police hostages in another area of the Amazon. 9 police officers died in the operation, 22 were freed and others were missing. The government did not say whether any protesters were killed in the rescue. However, the country's security forces now have a firm grip on the area and are enforcing a curfew in the three main towns, but these locals say the measures are preventing them from looking for the dead. President Alan Garcia has blamed foreign forces, widely understood to mean Bolivia and Venezuela, for inciting the unrest. He said they did not want Peru to use its natural resources for the good, growth and quality of life of its people. Fuel and transport blockades have disrupted Peru's Amazon region for almost 2 months. The indigenous tribes have vowed to keep up pressure until their demands are met.
Staying in the West, Cuba has reduced the rations of beans, peas and salt that it sells to the population. The move comes as the island is gripped by a global financial crisis. It imports around 80% of the food it sells at subsidized prices through their rationing books.
The amount of beans and peas Cubans receive monthly on the rationing cards decreased in June from 850 grams to 567. The quota of a quota of 1 kilo of salt was also cut in half. Cubans receive a monthly quota of subsidized food that includes rice, eggs, oil and sugar, among other products. The government has recognized that the quotas are not sufficient. According to academic reports, the quota lasts for 2 weeks. Like other Caribbean countries, Cuba has suffered the effects of the global financial crisis, which has in turn caused a reduction in export revenues and exhausted credits. According to foreign businesses, Cuba is suffering from a reduction in liquid assets that is affecting its ability to pay debts, therefore threatening to affect its import capacity. In June, the government implemented drastic measures to reduce its consumption of electricity. The government also warned that there could be blackouts down the line.
All right. June 10th, 2009, Cedric Muhammad Black Coffee Program. Let me comment on each of these. Let me hit Cuba and I'll work my way back to Peru. So as I was saying, I'm a great sympathetic admirer of Fidel Castro, the Comandante, right? And Hugo Chavez, and both of them acknowledged their black and indigenous roots, which I appreciate. But let me get into some history on Cuba, where things went wrong. Now I'm going to read you something that I wrote in 2003. It was an article in the Cuban news source, Granma Internacional. It was called 5,600 Price Violations Detected in the Country. Okay. And I wrote about it because there were some things that I saw that were important for things that we were getting into a Black Electorate Economic University. Now it says, now here's what I wrote. The problem which manifests itself in the form of fraud, misquotes, and off-the-book sales is of great concern to the Cuban government, which views the problem in terms of the lack of trust and inequality it creates in society. But the problem is much deeper and endemic than even the government supposes, and that is because the root of today's problem, and I'm tying this in with the rationing problem, they're rationing food in Cuba. Centrally planned government decisions are made from central authority regarding who gets what, when, and where. That's the basic question of every economic society. It's not socialist. It's not capitalist. It's not Islamic. It's human. It's universal. Who gets what, when, and where, and how? That's what economics is about. The distribution, the consumption, and the production of wealth. So, I'm saying that the root of today's problem lies not in dishonesty of those who run state enterprises and businesses in Cuba today. Rather, the beginning of Cuba's pricing crisis can be found in its political leadership's misunderstandings and incomplete application of what Karl Marx taught, and the context in which the Cuban Revolution was born. Without question, Fidel Castro and Che Guevara in many ways brilliantly interpreted Marx and even surpassed him in certain ways. The result is a society that develops its human capital better than most in the areas of education and health, but in the arena of financial capital, the country since its independence has been woefully languished in mediocrity that has it dependent to one degree or another on foreign currency, namely the U.S. dollar. How ironic that a country that prides itself on fending off imperialism and the capitalist philosophy of the United States has always privately sought U.S. dollars in great quantities to lubricate its struggling economy. Historians should remember the ironic situation, particularly in the 1960s, which found Cuba vainly pleading with the Soviet Union to make its purchases of Cuban sugar in U.S. dollars. Cuba has always needed dollars, primarily for imports. As you all know, things are denominated in dollars like oil. So there's an artificial or some call a superficial support underneath the dollar. So everyone needed dollars. But yeah, how ironic is that? Many people don't know this. But in the 60s, Cuba, at the height of the quote unquote Cold War, which I think was a 10% smokescreen, but that's a subject for another day. At the height of the Cold War, Cuba was asking the Soviet Union to buy sugar from it in U.S. dollars. How did this scenario develop where Cubans in government and among the masses covet the U.S. dollar more than their own currency, the peso? I'm going to give you just two more paragraphs on this. If anyone has, many of you have gone to Cuba, you know what it's like with the currency. Sometimes you use the dollar. Many of you are supporters of Cuba. I get a lot of love from Cuba. I just found out I have governmental love. Third party. I know not the guy that the State Department just outed as a spy. I don't know him. But I got love for the Cuba government, and the Cuban government has love for me. I have found out through an emissary. I hope giving praise to Cuba is not violating the embargo, is it? Receiving and giving praise to Cuba and from Cuba. I have not violated the embargo, have I? How stupid is that embargo, by the way? The OAS, the Organization of American States, just agreed to, what, let Cuba back in? How stupid is that? That you let foreign policy made in this country keep you from embracing your neighbor country. I mean, the power of America is so enormous. It's unbelievable in terms of foreign policy. Back to what I was saying. In a real sense, it could be explained that the U.S. refusal to purchase sugar from the country as a result of the revolution and Cuba's poor central planning in the aftermath is largely to blame for the country's monetary challenges. There is no reasonable dispute that the United States embargo on Cuba hurt the economy and hurt that country. Cuba lost a valuable trading partner for its chief commodity crop and a source of hard foreign currency that it needed to purchase and maintain machinery and equipment that it did not manufacture at home. So that's the point. Cuba needed dollars and still needs dollars because it has to buy machinery and equipment from abroad. You have to use dollars. That's why the same with my Zimbabwean family. I got love for Robert Mugabe. Deep love, admiration and respect for him. And the people of Zimbabwe that I've met, very proud. Very, they're like Mugabe. Mugabe speaks perfect English. He's very proper. A lot of his countrymen and women are like that. I find them to walk around and carry themselves with a high level of dignity. I was very impressed when I went to Kenya and met my family from Zimbabwe. Each one of the African nations and regions, they have their own flavor. It's very interesting to watch. But Zimbabwe now is using the U.S. dollar. Now, I wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal in the year 2000 where I said if they did not set up a currency board for that region and those countries in Southern Africa, if they didn't come together, then the dollar would be an option. So now in Zimbabwe, they're using the dollar in the open. People are actually enjoying it. This is what happens when you leave monetary policy and certain aspects of economics out of the revolution. Karl Marx gave teachings and insight on money that his devotees and followers today throughout the world ignore, don't know about, or refuse to follow. So I go on. The Cuban peso was inconvertible and the dollar was the most valuable convertible country in the world. One can find the most diplomatic of statements coming from Fidel Castro in 1959. and soon thereafter relative to the relationship that he desired with the United States. Fidel Castro never wanted a full economic rupture. And I know a lot of people try to romanticize about Castro today. You go back and you read his statements from 59. Very balanced, very diplomatic. He knew what he was getting himself into. But an excessive preoccupation with the U.S. embargo masks the fact that Cuba was able to more than make up for the loss in income it had received from the United States with increased trade with its communist bloc partners. Now listen carefully. While Cuba did in fact suffer a dramatic fall in sugar trade, its sugar production fell to 3.8 million tons in 1963 as opposed to 6 million tons in 1961. By 1964, Cuba had negotiated international long-term delivery contracts for 6 million tons of sugar at prices that rival those it earned from America. The rebound so emboldened Cuba's hopes that Fidel Castro pledged that his country would be at 10 million tons of sugar by the year 1970. So the argument that sugar trade losses spell the death knell of the economy are inaccurate. A much more subtle but lethal cause can be blamed for over four decades of problems in the Cuban economy, problems that can attribute to the country's price violations and challenges today. Now, this is not ideology. This is not you're not going to find, this is not me trying to hate or love Castro. I already told you I'm sympathetic. Hold on. I lost my bed, y'all. Damn it. I'm going to talk with no music. So my point is, with Cuba, don't hit me with ideology. Just hit me with facts. I just gave you the numbers. The sugar trade was hurt and then it bounced back. Cuba could have made up for everything that it had lost prior to 1961 or after 1961. By 1964, they were in line and they had this whole new block of countries to trade with. But all of the communist bloc nations had the same problem. So I say, like many of the countries that claim to be socialist or communist, Cuba has ignored its ideological patriarch's guidance on monetary matters. It is this oversight that may be as responsible for the fall of the communist socialist world as any other. While socialist nations have been quick to claim Karl Marx's criticism of capitalism, they have been slow or inert when it comes to gravitating towards a fundamental and egalitarian principle of building the economy that he envisioned. Marx identified a key to building a fair, equal, and just economy as he saw it in the unique ability of money to function as the measure of the ultimate value in a society, labor. Marx identified gold as best suited to serve in this capacity, which in itself would produce equality among all laborers, regardless of industry and society. In his book Capital, Marx wrote, now I don't know, if you all want more of this, I'll go deep into this. I was actually going to quote a section in Karl Marx's book where he talks about money and gold, or gold as the money par excellence. Okay, this is good, big, good discussion, good stuff. We got to do more of this because my job is not to just romanticize over what Castro has or hasn't done or what Chavez has or isn't doing. There's a lot of people think that makes you like you got some cause celebre. It's chic to go to Cuba or go to Venezuela and say you hung out with Chavez. But at the end of the day, the reality is things like Venezuela having lost millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that they had given, I think, to Lehman Brothers. I mean, all of these leaders, Gaddafi, Castro, Chavez, Evo Morales, they know that you have to play ball and that you are already playing ball. Those of us who are ideology first don't have pragmatism, which means we don't have a real practical view of the strategy and tactics that a leader like a Hugo Chavez would have to use in order to cope and survive and keep from being overthrown immediately. Okay, strategy, not ideology. Facts, history, strategy. You ain't helping Chavez and Castro by wearing no Che Guevara t-shirt. Feel me? You are not helping them at all. June 10th, 2009, Cedric Muhammad Black Coffee Program. I think I'll take a break. Those of you that want to advertise on this show, continue to fill out the Partner With Us form. I want to thank those of you who have expressed an interest. A show like this, how can I say? The model is to make this thing float by business and entrepreneurship, not charity, not grant money. Business. I have an audience. You have a product, a service. Let's enter into trade and commerce with one another. It's a good thing to do. It's the right thing to do. But let's do it because our mutual self-interest are served. And enlightened self-interest, that's what's lacking. Because of how we've been mistrained and how we deal with one another. If we just dealt with one another on the basis of self-interest and it was enlightened, we would probably take care of 60 to 50% of our remaining problems. That's why I put greater emphasis on business than I do on political ideology. Certain principles and things you can't get away with in business that you damn sure can get away with in politics. Oh, man. A lot more to go. We'll continue the battle of the greetings. Snoop D-O-double-G versus President Obama. Who gives the greetings better when we return?
Cedric Muhammad.
10th, 2009. Let me read a little bit of this story on what's going on in Peru. It's from the Washington Times. They say Peruvian suspect Chavez ties to Indian revolt. The Peruvian Congress is investigating financial links between the government of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and poor natives, whose nationwide protests over land and water rights turned violent Friday, leaving at least 30 people dead. For more than a month, Indian groups, drawn mostly from the vast Peruvian Amazon, have come out against a package of laws that would open their region to oil and gas drilling, hydroelectric projects, and biofuels farming. Wielding bows, spears, and shotguns, activists have overtaken jungle oil facilities, blocked tourist destinations, and cut off thoroughfares. The effort is intended to press Peruvian President Alan Garcia to repeal decrees that are designed to bring the country's economic framework in line with a U.S.-Peru free trade accord. At one point, Peru's state oil company was forced to shut down a key pipeline after Indians overran a pumping station. Now, I don't want to overload you today, but that Amazon thing is a monster. Now Christian missionaries and the CIA in the 80s, the 70s, the 60s, Nelson Rockefeller was also on the point. He was the a U.S. representative for Near Eastern Affairs. Nelson Rockefeller. That's the Rockefeller you want to follow if you're doing your 10% family tree. Nelson Rockefeller was the man on the point for the takeover and exploitation of the indigenous and native people in the Amazon region, which is rich. The Amazon region is one of the richest in the world for minerals. I have a mapping of the Amazon area. It's like Africa. It's got a lot of stuff, actually, that Africa doesn't have in the same supply. So all this talk about Chavez and Peru and Indians and native indigenous folks is really about the resources in this area. So the indigenous folks are right. This is a move to get some of the most unbelievable minerals on earth for strategic purposes, etc. But Wyclef Bible translators, I have to out you. Christian missionaries were used, you linguists. Here's what happened. Let me explain what happened. The corporations from the West, America and many European companies, have known for, you know, very long time what is underneath the earth and in the water and in the mountains of the Amazon, the Andes Mountains, that whole area, okay? But they through anthropological studies and whatnot, they've never been able to crack certain tribes, certain indigenous communities and native communities in Central and South America. So these people are not just going to give their land up. So through all type of machinations, urban displacement, rural displacement, urban repopulation schemes, all this stuff's going on right now with the backing of the United States government and other countries. They've been trying to get a lock hold in Colombia, in Peru, parts of Brazil. Every country in Central South America, to one degree or another, has this problem. I wish I had this map of the Amazon. I'd show you all what's sitting up in there. So in any event, the only way that they could come among the native people was to get linguists, study their language. I mean, they have languages that are way more sophisticated than English or any Western languages. The dialects and all of that. Some of the most sophisticated languages, nuanced languages, can be found among the indigenous communities in South America. So the people who were the best linguists were Christian missionaries. So this alliance eventually developed between linguists at the University of Chicago, Christian missionaries who had gone throughout Asia, Central South America, and parts of Africa, and the intelligence agencies of the United States. The intelligence community, just like they had this problem with people who were not Arabic speakers, they have had a problem in mapping and learning the languages of the indigenous communities of Central South America. So this unholy alliance formed between linguists in learning centers throughout America, particularly in Chicago, in the Midwest area, Rockefeller-affiliated institutions, and Bible translators, Christian missionaries like the Wycliffe Bible Translation Organization, and the CIA and the State Department, and corporations that wanted to get their hands on, quote-unquote, rare, precious, strategic minerals. Okay, that's what this is all about. So Chavez, he may or may not be backing these groups, but if he is, I understand why. And if they're fighting back, I understand why. That's what I'm saying. You're not helping nobody by putting on a Che Guevara t-shirt. You ain't gonna stop none of that. Feel me? Okay, let's go to Malawi and Namibia, because I want to bear witness to a point I expressed about Cuba. All of these countries need foreign exchange. So they dig up things from their earth. They're blessed with many natural resources in these countries in Africa. And of course, they sell it. That's the export driven model that we talked about that Asia is trying to get away from. Africa running to it. Asia trying to get away from digging things up out of the earth and selling them for dollars or euros. Here's what's going on in Namibia and Malawi. Through these things called the economic partnership agreements, European countries are trying to get around regional integration efforts or autonomous, independent regional efforts by Africans to unite their economies and increase intra-African trade rather than trade with foreign continents. But the president, I believe, of Malawi, he says something. I have to stomach it. I understand why he's saying it. But let's look at Namibia and then Malawi. This is from SABC, South African Broadcasting Corp.
Business now, the European Union has signed provisional economic partnership agreements with Botswana, Lesotho, and Swaziland. The bloc plans to do the same with Mozambique. Angola opted not to sign the commitment, as did South Africa and Namibia. The EU has been accused of bullying trade negotiations by some African countries.
Namibia is the latest African country to demand publicly that Europe stop its bully trade negotiations. It said it will only sign any EPA agreements with Europe if new wordings are introduced and continuous issues resolved. The EU has been negotiating EPAs for several years with four separate regional blocs: the Economic Communities of South Africa, or the SADC, the West Africa, ECOWAS, Central Africa, and East Africa. The EPA trade agreement is not only imposed on African governments, but will join these regions' economies and give Europe's biggest business a monopoly, which experts say it is anti-development. But the EU wants to renegotiate after criticism from both the United Nations institutions and African experts. Negotiations continue for the conclusion of definitive EPA, With countries belonging to the South African Development Community, or the SADC, the initial deadline set for concluding negotiations was December 2007 to coincide with the Lisbon summit, but several countries at the time called for the agreement not to be signed. They claimed that access by European products to African markets free of custom taxes will affect the development of the local community, hence Brussels was forced to extend negotiations. The EPAs replaced the preferential trade system between the European Union and Africa, which the World Trade Organization said did not comply with the current international regulations.
And Malawi's recently re-elected President Binguwa Mutharika has ambitious plans to step up his country's economic growth into a higher gear. And he's keenly eyeing investors to help grow and diversify the economy. The Economist Intelligence Unit has forecast that Malawi will have the world's fastest growing economy after Qatar this year.
Unlike many countries on the African continent and around the world, which have fallen victim to the global financial crisis, Malawi's economic growth rate, however, is considered the world's second fastest this year. According to the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF, Malawi's economy grew by an estimated 9.7% in 2008, boosted by an expansion of its telecommunications industry, high tobacco sales, and strong maize harvest. And President Binguwa Mutharika, re-elected last month, wants to capitalize on this. He outlined his plans for his second term to reporters, saying investors will play a key role in helping diversify Mali's economy away from tobacco and ensure stability. Tobacco is Malawi's biggest foreign exchange earner, accounting for more than 70% of exports. But for the last 2 years, low prices have led to cuts in production. Mutharika wants to develop the country of 30 million people into a food exporting nation, with rice production amongst the top of the list. The president cautioned, though, that they must act fast to take advantage of opportunities on world markets.
Right now, with the green belt, one of our, big earning.
Okay, I got to break in. This is the president of Malawi, and he is bragging about his country thriving or having the opportunity to thrive by selling more commodities. Now, Africa is never going to get out of the condition it's in economically until it gets away from the export-driven model where you export everything that grows underneath your feet to the rest of the world and then don't develop a broad economy. This is what I'm talking about, the need for entrepreneurship in Africa. China's going through it now. When the rest of the world can't buy your goods, Cuba going through it now. When the rest of the world can't buy your goods, you have a shortfall of foreign exchange. You can't buy things that you need that are denominated in dollars, and you have to cut back, which is why Cuba is rationing food now. Other countries are doing what they're doing. But listen to his, he's actually bragging about this. I kind of understand why. I don't want to be too hard on him.
Crops will be rice. Because there's heavy demand and there's shortage of rice globally. At the moment, the major rice producers, India, Pakistan, Indonesia, People's Republic of China, and I think Malaysia, and they are not producing enough. So if Malawi can quickly move with this green belt thing and produce a lot of rice, rice can compete favorably with tobacco in terms of foreign earnings.
The president added that mining could also become Malawi's top foreign currency earner.
We're going to go into gold mining. We're going to go into bauxite mining. We have bauxite. We have gold. We have heavy mineral sands, right? We have emeralds and precious metals. We have them. So I think that that will help us to diversify the economy.
The IMF has forecast strong growth for the country in 2009 as a result of another good harvest and the start of uranium production, but has warned of risks from the global economic downturn.
So we're going to go to bauxite and uranium from rice. Let me put the camera on me. Let me read your comments. Hopefully you have a good idea. The dilemma of the African leaders is that they need foreign exchange. And they have not necessarily. And let me say this about Cuba. The reason why Cuba is just a gold mine waiting to happen, so to speak, in terms of human capital, is because the people are well, relatively speaking, well fed. They're literate, well-educated. They may make some of the best entrepreneurs in the world if they were allowed to have more leeway. I don't think you would have the rationing kind of problems you're having if you had a greater entrepreneurial class. Not foreign direct investment from foreign corporations, but an indigenous, domestic, national entrepreneurial class that would emerge from the poor. Cam from Paterson, New Jersey, he says that, brother, as much as I like President Obama's enunciation of the greetings, there's something about the southern drawl and confidence of Snoop's that makes me give him my vote. Snoop Dogg. Snoop is leading in the vote. People prefer the way that Snoop gives the greetings of Assalamu Alaikum. Rod Ginyard has found a online version of Das Kapital. Bibliomania, he says, has it. And he is right. There was a quote that I was going to read from Karl Marx. It was two quotes. He found one of them. Rod Ginyard says, these are the words of Marx in Money or Circulation of Commodities in the chapter on that chapter in Das Kapital. It might be worth reading. Throughout his work, this work, I assume for the sake of simplicity, gold as the money commodity. The first chief function of money is to supply commodities with the material for their expression of their values, or to represent their values as magnitudes of the same denomination, qualitatively equal and quantitatively comparable. It thus serves as a universal measure of value, and only by virtue of this function does gold, the equivalent commodity par excellence, become money. Now, I'm not going to go too deep into this. That is the quote. If you are a student of Karl Marx, that is the quote, or at least one half, or one of two quotes that I am stating directly, that the communist and socialist countries have not heeded. They don't understand what money is. And so the critique of capitalism misses the fact that money is just the form. It's the medium, as Karl Marx is saying, by which everything else expresses itself in the same denomination. So in my book, I talk about a 5-person economy where 80 different goods are made. If you have an economy where 80 different goods are made, you have, and everything is barter and you trade and one good for another, you would have to keep track of thousands of prices each day. Each day. That's why you can't ration. You don't know what to charge. You don't know the supply of money. You don't know the demand for money. So Karl Marx was stating that if you would just allow money to be qualitatively equal, the same denomination, and quantitatively comparable, you would allow every other good and service in the economy to speak the same language. So if I make quilts and you make TVs and you make food and she makes guitars and he makes medicine, how in the world are we going to figure out how much to make and how to trade with one another if we don't have one form of money that doesn't change in value, by which we can express all of the products that we make? So here's what Karl Marx said. The first chief function of money is to supply commodities. And that, what he means by commodities, he means everything that's being made. Commodities with the material for the expression of their values, or to represent their values as magnitudes of the same denomination, qualitatively equal, quantitatively comparable. A dollar makes everything else comparable. If you didn't have money, you would not know how to compare a TV with a computer, with a dinner, with a haircut. You'd be guessing every day what to charge. Everything would have a fluctuating price. Cuba never got that right after its sugar imports stabilized after the 1964 period. Sugar imports did fall from 61 to 64. They were back by 64. The other problem, which I mentioned, is the Czech economist. The Cuban economy was actually planned by Czechoslovakian economists, okay? Let me read Bruce from Chesterfield, Virginia. I'm going to read another comment he gave earlier. He says, I'm what you call an American black, but my tenacity came from watching and hanging around other black cultures, such as Caribbean, African, Asian blacks. It's unfortunate, but it's the truth. One more thing. When I embarked on my journey, I was fully prepared to live in my car if I needed to, or if need be. But I weighed the options and said to myself, what's the worst that can happen? If my business fails, I just have to get a job again. Not a bad trade-off compared to providing for yourself. My next move is to give back and teach what I've learned to my community to help free people's minds. But first, I had to walk the talk before I can convince someone else it can be done. That's Bruce from Chesterfield, Virginia. Let me give you some more on his background that formed the teachings of Bruce. The teachings of Bruce come from this. 1997, 12 years in the corporate America IT industry. Year 2000, age of 28, he achieved the so-called American Dream home. He became a homeowner, sports car owner, luxury sedan, but he was slaving to make the bill payments. Doing well for my age, but I still could not feel fulfilled, especially working for someone else. In the year 2001, 9/11 hit, and the first thing that I did was refinance my house, 5.5%, and I stacked a little paper. 2005, I decided to make a change and step out on my own. Everybody listen up. This is the teachings of Bruce. Bruce from Virginia. This is how he did it. 2005, I decided to make a change and step out on my own. I saw where the housing market was going in 2006. I purposely foreclosed on my house and sold my cars, defaulted on my credit cards, and brought a $2,000 hoopty. 2007, got laid off for the third time. But remember, I'm prepared for this. 1 year earlier, 2008, went back to work, got laid off in 3 months. And those who knew thought I was crazy, but I had a dream to do it on my own. And yes, I did not tell family members to prevent them from deterring me. In 2008, collected unemployment checks and funded my business. This is gangster. Since being laid off, I've had more money cash on hand than when I was fully employed. I'm spiritually happier. Financially, I'm richer. Now I'm setting up for permanent retirement. I learned a valuable lesson. Even if I have to go back to work, never again will I be a corporate sharecropper because I now know how to make my own money. When the banks don't lend, I use the job as my lender. And yes, I voted for Terry McAuliffe, but I wouldn't really consider myself a Democrat. Woo! Bruce, I may have to read your post over Madonna's outro. Now, Bruce just laid it out on the line. He broke down exactly what he had to do. Hour number four, we'll talk about the condition of Brother Jibril Muhammad, do the album reviews, 311 and Julian Marley. I'm going to talk a little bit about Turkey, and I'll do my review of President Obama's speech to the Muslim world. And I think has folks a little bit uncomfortable, but we'll talk about that. Also, I got a letter. I'm going to read that. Somebody wants to take me to task, and they did it so nicely. I'm going to read the whole thing on air. Hour number four, hottest show in the diaspora, Cedric Muhammad Black Coffee Program. Go tell somebody. If you know another show is hotter, let me know. Bruce from Virginia, an entrepreneur by choice. This goes out to all the entrepreneurs by necessity.
Cedric Muhammad.
What is with that track? You still got
you know what? Dudes Rob, coming into Hi Rob is, I was playing it at the time. I'm on Columbia Records. I got a release date coming. And there's no buzz surrounding the record. When you're in my situation, there's no plan B. You know, it's music or we sell crack. Because that's what we did before we did music. You understand what I mean? And in that environment, it may seem harsh even when I say exactly what it is. You know, but that's what it is. That's what we did before we had the opportunity to do music. So it's a blessing. I am so happy to be where I'm at now that, you know, I would never, I would feel like I would be hustling backwards to go into doing something like that at this point. But at that particular time, that was what was provided for us to provide for ourselves in that environment. So that's what we did. And
Cedric Muhammad.
When you don't have an option, it absolutely has to work for you, you know? So I'm like, I got to make a record that makes everybody stop right now and say, who's this guy 50 Cent? Right now, who is this guy, you know? And then the creative part, I got $65,000 in advance from Columbia. $50,000 went to Jam Master Jay to negotiate the release from JMJ Records. $10,000 went to the attorney that drew the contracts up between me and Columbia and the release between me and Jam Master Jay. It left me with $5,000, and I was out there for over a year before the record came out. So I was back selling crack. How else you gonna provide? How else would I provide for myself and then be on call and able to be in the studio whenever the company called me to actually be there?
Cedric Muhammad.
You know, and at the end of that situation, it led back to High Rob. I'm like, you know, it doesn't matter to me, you know, if anyone's upset. You know, actually, it's in their best interest. I've had phone calls from people that you would think be upset, and now they're interested in doing music.
Yeah.
You know, it's hilarious because I'm like, hell no.
June 10th, 2009. Send your comments in. If you're corporate thugging or sharecropping, you know I'm here for you. I think we had a slight period of dead air. I gotta get a new sound effect. Flavor Flav is telling Chuck they can't keep a good man down. What song is that? Black Steel in the Hour of Chaos? Correct me if I'm wrong. Yes, Glenn from Philly says, Bruce from Virginia's story is incredible. Talk about a man finding the utility and blessings in what most would consider a tough situation. That type of strategy in the face of adversity takes a lot of internal belief and discipline. We're going to reread Bruce from Virginia's post. And Glenn, with your permission, Glenn, I think you are the Barry Windham of our four horsemen. I wouldn't say Ole or Arn Anderson, of course, taken already can't apply. Well, we're going to reconstitute the four horsemen. Me and Glenn are in. We need two new members. Bruce from Virginia is up for nomination. That story is so gangster, we might have to. Glenn, with your permission, let's nominate Bruce to become. Well, let's just put him under consideration. We'll talk to Bruce about it. Bruce is so gangster, he may not want to join a group. He's a weapon of mass destruction by himself. All right, let me. We covered a lot of ground today, but let me talk about something very, very important. Let me give you a visual aid. We'll talk about Brother Jabril Muhammad. It's actually very hard to even find a picture of Jabril. That's how unassuming he is. There we go. All right. So the gentleman on the left, you know who that is. Hopefully you know, but in case you don't, that's the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan on the left. This is from Savior's Day of this year, 2009. And the gentleman on the right, handsome with the bow tie on, that's Brother Jabril Muhammad. One of the rare photos you will find out there. Let me read an update on his medical condition, and then I will read something to give you a little bit of an idea of who he is. If you don't know already, a lot of people know who he is who are listening, but there are a significant number of those who don't know. So this is available in a few places. One of the places, and I would say this is the most important place to go if you're trying to get updates or a historical reference on Brother Jabril's medical condition since 2007 in particular, go to the website cuttingedgeknowledge.org. That's CUTTINGEDGE knowledge, NOWLEDGE.org. Cuttingedgeknowledge.org. That has not just the current update that I'm about to read, but also the prior updates and a public statement that he made going back to last year, okay? CuttingEdgeKnowledge.org is the site. And at BlackElectorate.com, we just posted this update. Now, let me read this. This is not boring reading at all. Those of you may see yourself in this, a suffering family member. Very inspiring. This is Aphasia 8 Medical Update Number 1 on the condition of Brother Jabril Muhammad. This is written by Bettina Muhammad, NDCNC. These are acronyms. Doctor. Naturopath. It's Francis, this is a confidential update regarding Brother Jibril Muhammad's medical condition. Anything having to do with one's medical condition is considered to be confidential. Brother Jibril wants to share this with the readers. Before this report was sent publicly, I gave Brother Jibril a copy of it for his review. For those of you who know Brother Jibril, you know that he is a context and detail person. As you read this report, the words that are in bold are the part that I omitted that he wanted included in this update. He told me to please read the final call for his reasons. Smile. He gave me these words today, Monday, June 8, 2009, the same day I wrote this report. He told me that his reason would appear, Allah willing, in next week's issue of the Final Call newspaper. On Wednesday, May 27, 2009, Brother Jibril Muhammad was admitted to the hospital. His diagnosis was unresponsive and seizure disorder. He went into respiratory failure while in the emergency room and was intubated. He was not breathing on his own. The emergency room doctors worked to stabilize his condition before transferring him to neuro ICU. One of the emergency room doctors wrote in his dictated medical report, quote, he, Jibril, was admitted and was witnessed to have convulsions in the ER, now in respiratory failure and on a ventilator without showing signs of recovery, end quote. Throughout his medical records, other words to that effect were stated. He was in extreme critical condition with his arterial blood gases all over the place, end quote. That's a quote, all over the place, end quote. I witnessed everything that took place in the emergency room helping the doctors help Brother Jibril. I informed them what medicines works best for him while he's in this condition, etc. I also witnessed that he was unresponsive even to pain. After I informed the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan from the emergency room of Brother Jibril's condition, he was very sorry to hear of what happened. Minister Farrakhan was already scheduled to come to Phoenix on another matter, so the next morning, Brother Minister and his two sons arrived at the hospital straight from the airport. They arrived in the room approximately 1 minute or less after five or six neurologists arrived in his room. I was in the process of giving all the doctors a complete medical history of Brother Jibril's condition. I informed them of what medications and dosage of medications he's taking, how often he has these episodes, how to prevent these episodes from getting to the point where he's intubated, etc., etc. They asked a few questions, which I answered, and at one point I politely advised them to decrease one of his IV medications and gave my reasons, which they agreed to do, and they did. They also told me of their plans, of which I was 100% in agreement. Minister Farrakhan witnessed Brother Jibril on the ventilator, hand strapped to the bed to prevent him from pulling out his tubes. After the doctors left, Minister Farrakhan remarked, quote, I'm so sorry this happened to you, but Allah is the best knower, end quote. Brother Minister then leaned over to Brother Jibril and said in a loud voice, quote, Jib, get up out of this bed. We have work to do, end quote. Brother Jibril opened his eyes and immediately recognized Minister Farrakhan. Brother Jibril tried to speak but choked and started coughing because of the tube he had down his throat to help him breathe. Brother Minister then quieted Brother Jibril and told him in a soft voice that he will be back once the tube is removed from his throat. Absolutely, Allah is the best knower. A few hours after the visit from Minister Farrakhan, Brother Jibril was extubated, meaning that he was taken off life support. Brother Jibril's first words after being extubated was, quote, how long have I been here, end quote. Because of the heavy sedation Brother Jibril was given over the last 24 hours, he slept the rest of that day. He awoke the next morning around 5 a.m. and told me that he saw Minister Farrakhan face to face and that it was real. He said that he saw him in, quote, this same building, end quote. He then asked me, quote, what's up, end quote. Now, keep in mind, Brother Jibril is just waking up from heavy sedation, from being on a ventilator, life support, and he does not realize that he is in the hospital. But one thing for sure, he told me that he knew that he saw Minister Farrakhan. After orientating Brother Jibril to place and time, I informed him that he did indeed see Minister Farrakhan. I also informed Brother Jibril that he had a tube down his throat to help him breathe and could not talk to Minister Farrakhan, although he tried, and that Minister Farrakhan will be coming back this morning to see him. Minister Farrakhan and his son Joshua came that morning to see Brother Jibril. I can say that I witnessed a very powerful and significant meeting between the two of them. Sister Monet, who works for me and is 1 month away from getting her RN degree, witnessed what she did. Allah willing, we'll hear from her in Aphasia 9, Medical Update number 2. In the 1 hour plus meeting, I could see that they were affecting or being affected by one another's spirit. At the end of their meeting, Minister Farrakhan actually mentioned that this meeting helped his spirit. I know from a medical standpoint that Brother Jibril was helped in many ways. I believe this accounted for his speedy recovery. In 2006, I was blessed to be present during some of the questions raised by Brother Jibril to Minister Farrakhan for the Closing the Gap book. This meeting between the two of them reminded me of that time period. They were ready right then and there to go to work. As Minister Farrakhan told Brother Jibril on the first day of his visit to Brother Jibril, despite Brother Jibril's condition, that, quote, we have work to do, end quote. That caused Brother Jibril to open his eyes. I must make this very clear. I've heard rumors, even as of yesterday, that Brother Jibril is in and out of a coma, that Brother Jibril is mentally off due to the stroke he suffered in February 2007. Both of those statements are completely false and baseless. For those who continue to spread these kinds of rumors over the last 2.5 years since his stroke of February 2007, where is your proof? Remember what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us, that Minister Farrakhan continues to teach and remind us of, that if you repeat slander 3 times, you become a part of it. For those of you who have known Brother Jibril for however many years, he is still the same brother. Well, let me put it this way. He is not the same brother. Nobody goes through a near-death experience and comes out of it the same. Brother Jibril had more than one near-death experience. Our brother is stronger mentally. The part of his brain that was affected by the stroke was the part that controls speech. Brother Jibril can speak. Brother Jibril can write. Brother Jibril can read. He has problems retrieving words, but if one is patient with him, he can get the word out that he is searching for. Please study conduction aphasia and go back over aphasia parts 1-7 that he produced at cuttingedgeknowledge.org. This aphasia condition has absolutely nothing to do with intelligence. His intelligence is above average. He can make informed decisions for himself. I must state for the record that a seizure that he just suffered does not cause brain damage. I pray Allah that this short writing will clear up some of the major misunderstandings about our brother's condition. I was talking to a few neurologists at the hospital. All of us agreed that Brother Jibril has an above average intelligence and thought process. That part of his brain that processes thoughts and intelligences carries over to the language part. He uses many what you called coping strategies to communicate due to his condition. Coping strategies are verbal or nonverbal methods of communicating used by people who have aphasia. He can make himself very clear when he speaks. It's been 1 week since Brother Jibril was discharged from the hospital. If you were to see him now, you would hardly believe that he, just a few days earlier, was seconds away from death and on life support. Many have told me that he looks even younger or healthier now than he looked before this most recent hospitalization, even though he's not out of it yet. In Aphasia 9 or Medical Update 2, I intend to go into this. I agreed with Minister Farrakhan's words 1,000% when he said that Allah is the best knower. I can say this, he is speaking better than he was before this most recent episode. All praises are due to Allah. Thank you for reading this short update. Please continue to visit as more updates are forthcoming, Allah willing. Patina Muhammad, ND, CNC, June 8, 2009. Now that's from cuttingedgeknowledge.org, cuttingedgeknowledge.org, and it's up at blackelectorate.com.